Hello, fellow Rebel Capitalists. Hope you're well. We are going to do a deep dive. I'm super excited to get into the markets and the action that we have seen in the stock market over the last couple days. If you haven't been following on the day after Thanksgiving, market down by almost 1,000 points. And then it jumped up, I believe, the next day. And just massive volatility is the bottom line. And I'm really a long-term guy, so this day-to-day stuff, I don't get into it, but I think it's fascinating. I think it's something we all need to be cognizant of. But the best trader I know is a guy named Tony Greer, and this is what he does for a living. He's been doing it for decades. It's his job to make sure that he understands the rhythms of the market. So when we see this volatility, Tony's the guy to really find out if we should expect this to continue, or if it's something that, you know, is kind of a flash in the pan due to the news that we've been having with the Scariant. So I'm just really fascinated to get Tony's take, and you guys are going to get a ton of value. But he's just on a call right now. He's going to chime in here in a moment. But before we get to that point, give Tony some time here. I want to go to a chart just to make sure that we're all on the same page. So I pulled up the S&P 500 over the past 5 days. And here is when it looks like, and this was on very low volume on Black Friday, you know, not too many traders and not too many people are in doing what they do. So I think it gapped down, if I'm not mistaken, and then it closed down about 900 points roughly. And then you can see here on, I guess this would be Monday, it goes up pretty significantly. I think it starts, I can't do the math in my head really, but I think it was up maybe 600 points, but ends the day kind of on a low, or not really a low, but on a downtrend. And then the next day, this would be Tuesday, we're down big again, maybe not as big as we were on Friday, but still gap down, tried to get up, but then it closes pretty much at the lows of the day, which is not a good sign. And then yesterday, and this is kind of what really made me open my eyes. Sure, there's volatility from now and then. We've got the Scariant. I think that's the market sees that as potentially big news. I think the bond market and the gold market, like we said in the last video, that's what it could be shouting at us that, hey, guys, we're going to go into more lockdowns. Therefore, the stock market's going to take a big hit. I think we've seen yields go to, what's the 10-year right now, Josh? Is it down around 1.4, isn't it? Yeah, he's going to find out in just a moment. But I would assume that the yields on the 10-year have gone down since Thanksgiving, which would mean the price go up because you see a capital rotation from risk assets, stock market, into risk off assets like bonds. But then, like I was saying yesterday, we had this huge reversal day. And I know I'm curious to get Tony's take on this, but I don't know a lot about technical analysis, but I have read a couple books on candlestick charting. And I know that when you have a day where it's like a T, where you kind of, or a day where it goes up quite a bit, but then goes down, ends on a low on a lot of volume. Now, I can't see the volume here, but this is something that I'm going to ask Tony. That means that you should expect, or the probability is most high, that you'll continue to see downward pressure in the stock market. And then today, it looks like we're up, maybe up, you know, 60 points, something like that. So the market's kind of taking a breather. Before Tony gets on here, I would guess he would say to a trader and someone who has been using technical analysis for decades, this is an ugly chart. And this would imply that the probability was highest that we're going to see more downward pressure on the market in the few weeks to come here. And we'll have to see what the response is by the Federal Reserve and the government. I'm really curious to hear what Tony thinks about that, because, you know, Powell has acknowledged just yesterday that inflation is not transient, or at least he's going to stop using that word. And Goldman Sachs is saying that the Fed is most likely going to raise rates three times in 2022. And to do that, keep in mind, they have to take the quantitative easing down to zero. So how does that play out if we have the stock market crashing as a result of this most recent scarient, or whyever it is crashing? So there's a lot of drama, to say the least. So let's go over to the CNBC homepage and go through that so we can get some context around what's happening with the stock market. So here we see stocks rebound sharply. Oh, I'm sorry. So it wasn't up 60 points. It was up 600 points. Okay. So that's a little different. Excuse me. I was slightly off by a factor of 10 there. So the stock market up 600 points. So basically we're having, you know, very similar to what we saw in March, where we were first, or well, at least the market was first introduced to the Cerveza sickness. I was talking about it along with Eric Townsend and Chris Martinson. And those guys talked about it before I did. I really got it from them. That was back in January of 2020. But then in late February, March, of course, the market starts to absorb this. And that's kind of what we saw. We'd see a huge up day, and then we'd see a huge down day. And we just had a lot more down days, and that kind of accelerated. And the next thing you know, you're down 20 or 30% from the highs. Bottom line is huge volatility is what we can see in the market. So what's the VIX right now, Josh? So Josh was telling me yesterday it was up near 30. He's saying today right around 27. So that implies, or the VIX is trying to tell us, that we've got some extreme volatility in the market. And my base case right now is that this will continue. You know, I on a side note, this article caught my eye, this headline, when I was researching it earlier, that Chainos reveals his short position in DraftKings because of insane marketing spend. I can pretty much confirm that, because literally every single I've never placed a sport bet in my life. Well, maybe with some of my buddies or something, but not officially. I'm not into sports betting at all in any way, shape, or form. But man, almost every video I click, or I rarely do watch TV, but when I watch it, it's like, it seems as though a large percentage of the commercials are for DraftKings or some sort of gambling or betting website. So that's makes sense. But then also, you know, we're just living, this emphasizes the fact that we're living in this bizarre world where these corporations don't have to make money at all, and they can access the credit markets or the capital markets for pretty much limitless money. And when money is free and you can get limitless amounts of it, what ends up happening is you get these corporations and entities that are growing at any cost, and they don't care about profit. They don't care about how much money they burn or their run rate. All they care about is growth. And as Jim Chanos says, that's a bad business model. When you're selling $20 for $10 and trying to make it up on volume over the long run, that dog don't hunt. And okay, let's go over there. Hey, what's up, buddy?
How are you, George?
I'm really well. So we've got you live with 56 people here on the Rebel Capitalist channel. We said that you were coming in, so I wanted to get your take on the market volatility that we've seen since Friday, and just hear your thoughts, and then we'll take a couple calls from some viewers that might have some questions for you. So
yeah,
I first pulled up a chart of the actually, you know, before we go into that, Tony, for the viewers who might not know your backstory, can you just give us a brief kind of summary of how long you've been trading markets?
Yeah, absolutely, George. I got out of Cornell University in 1990, determined to become a trader. My dad was a 30-year over-the-counter trader for Dean Witter. And I started off in, I'm just going to cut it really quick. I divide my career in half. The first 10 years from 92 to 2000, I was essentially an FX and commodities trader. I spent the bulk of that 6 years at J. Aron, the commodity trading arm of Goldman Sachs. I had a great run there, was there through the IPO, was invested personally and heavily in tech stocks for the, you know, late 90s run, et cetera, et cetera. And I decided that I wanted to go and do that full time. So I walked face first into the internet bubble and sat down to trade tech stocks and left Goldman Sachs in March of 2000 with the NASDAQ at 5K and oil at $10 and nobody cared. And then, yeah, and then things changed really rapidly. You know, the NASDAQ got cut in half and then some. The Bloomberg commodity, at the time, the Goldman Sachs commodities index, the book that I had been running, basically went on a 200% run. And so I had already segued out of commodity trading into equity trading in my own business. And that business lasted a year and a half until I had to sort of, you know, we kind of packed up and went our separate ways and there was no blood there. We all survived financially. But then I had to go back and restart my career with a seat at a shop. So I wound up pivoting into equity sales, because I realized that a lot of my contacts had, you know, equity trading pads, either at hedge funds, mutual funds, and I had this great commodity trading background. And so I started writing a note in the morning to one client on the West Coast to tell him what was going on in the macro markets. Mm-hmm. And from that one note, he was passing it along to some of his friends. And after, you know, fast forward 10 years into my equity sales trading career across about five or six different shops, that list grew to about 1500 people. And then I decided to kind of branch off and go on my own because I was tired of playing pickup basketball with my career and going from shop to shop to shop my book of business and fighting with managers about percentages. And it was all a bunch of horseshit to me. So I just kind of pulled that out and started talking about markets and devised my own system over the years of trading them and following them. That's been, knock on wood, pretty successful. And 5 years into writing the Morning Navigator, you know, the business has grown tremendously. I've got a publication business, an execution business, and a consulting business. And I love being part of Rebel Capitalist Pro with you guys.
Where can people subscribe to your do you have like a weekly newsletter that goes out for retail?
I write four newsletters a week, George. The Morning Navigator sells four times a week, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday. You can go to tgmacro.com and get that's my website. It's pretty transactional and crisp and kind of just tells what the Navigator is about. And then I have a more upscale package where I have, I write an extra long form report every quarter. That's kind of my world, 30,000 foot up view of the markets. Yeah. And I have a Slack channel with, I call the TG Macro Trading Desk, where people that participate in that Point Lookout package jump into the Slack channel with me and have access to me all the time. And I've got access to them. And I'm really proud of the network that I've built in there. There are a lot of ninja traders from all points of the world. And we try to talk about making money all day, but it's very much like a trading desk. And so that's kind of my, you know, my offering right now.
Oh, okay. So before we get into the market volatility, which is what I wanted to make this about, but now I've got a lot of questions that pop into mind. First and foremost, you were right in the thick of things, in the trenches, in the last dot-com bust. Yeah. And I'm looking around me today, like literally today, and last night, and I just, it's hard for me to even get my head around how big of a bubble we're in, not just in the stock market, but when you throw in cryptocurrencies, and when you throw in NFTs, when you throw in these meme stocks and people just chasing these insane returns. And, you know, I was at Mark Moss's event speaking a couple weekends ago, and a gentleman came up to me at the cocktail hour there and wanted to get my opinion on a couple kind of random crypto, like not Bitcoin or Ethereum, but some kind of smaller cryptocurrencies. I said, you know what? Honestly, I haven't done the homework there. That's not really kind of my thing. And he said, well, let me just tell you what I've done, and maybe you can give me some advice on what to do with the gains. I said, okay, yeah, sure. So like a year and a half ago, he put $4,000 into one of these smaller cryptocurrencies. Now that's worth $1 million. With another cryptocurrency, he did that with like 10 or 15,000. Now that's worth 4 million. And
God bless him.
Yeah. Yeah. But I sit there and I'm like, what type of productivity? Cause usually you've got to produce to consume, but now we've got this market where these people have just staggering gains. And we're not just talking about Stan Druckenmiller or Soros gains or Jim Rogers or Warren Buffett. We're talking about 100x that.
And wealth creation, right?
I don't know, because they're not creating, we're taking the emphasis off of creating goods and services, because these people, these smart people, they could be producing stuff, which would make society richer as a whole. But yet now it seems all of our focus is on chasing Shiba Inu or something like that. Well, and I'm like, how does this end? Like, what's the end game here?
Well, there's a war on stuff making.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, stuff making isn't a good business lately, right? If you're in the fossil fuel business, the government's at war with you. If you have a transportation around the world business, you're struggling through this supply chain crisis. So the stuff business is having a tough time right now, you know, George?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Good way to put it. Was that the same thing that you saw in the late 90s?
But, you know, it was, there are echoes of the cryptocurrency market's personality that very much rhyme with 99 and 2000, which I was in the thick of with, you know, going to sleep at night with 35 equity positions as a commodity trader, you know, in my PA and, you know, knowing all the names that I was in pretty intimately and knowing what was going on. And it was, you know, the wild thing about it was that it was a true bull to bear market, meaning a true bull market in that, you know, a company would come out that was on a tear, they would blow it on earnings, the stock would dislocate 5% lower, and by the end of the week, it was up 10%. Bull market, right?
And now it's up 100%.
Right, and stuff like that. So I'm saying, and then in the bear market, once things changed after March of 2000, it was companies doing better, beating earnings, and the stock getting annihilated, right? So it was, for me, that was the first time witness of, like, holy shit, this is the difference between a bull market and a bear market. That's what I really learned through that exercise. The bull market is we throw bad news out the window. The bear market is we throw good news out the window because they're going down. And that all just has to do with timing. And I think maybe a lot of, you know, central bank management, et cetera, as we get into this type of market. But there are some echoes of what it felt like.
Tony, how do people lose money in a bubble? And I know it sounds like a very, like an overly simplistic question, but what I mean is, you know, this gentleman that I'm referring to, his portfolio went from, let's just call it 15,000 with the one trade up to 4 million. So historically, I know that retail investors, they're the ones that usually lose money. It is what it is. So is it that these people, they make a lot of money and they start to believe that they're maybe they confuse brains for a bull market, like Rick Rule says. And then once their 4 million maybe goes down to 3 million, they're like, well, what's gotten me this far is to have diamond hands and continue to buy the dip. And now I'm, you know, I was at 4 million. Now I'm pissed that I'm at 3 because I was factoring my new lifestyle on 4 and I want to get to 10. So I'm going to buy the dip on leverage at 3, and then it continues to go down, and they buy the dip again and continue to do that until they're completely wiped out. Is that usually how the retail guy kind of loses money when that bull market turns into a bear market?
That's very accurate, George. I have a great, I mean, you know, similar story to your gentleman friend that made money in these, you know, altcoins, et cetera, et cetera. Back in the, you know, during the dot-com bubble, it was young guys that were investing in this market, and they would marry a stock, and they would marry a stock of a ticker that would be, that is gone today, like SDLI or something like that, you know, or JDS Uniphase, right? One of those old school bubble names, right? Yeah. And they would marry the name. And like you said, the name would make them rich, right? And so what happens is they get dogma and they get religion on that. And that made them rich, right? And then the stock pulls back. And like you say, their dogma leads them to say, and I could quote a young investor that got blown out during the dot-com bubble. I remember him telling me, like, I can't imagine the stock. You really can't see it going under 100.
Right.
With a straight face. And me and my buddy that were in the conversation with him look at each other and we're like, you know, knowing that this kid just made himself six figures in a stock that, you know, he's a young guy. And then you hear him saying, I can't see it going below that price. And you say, well, what's at that price? Right. And he's like, you know, this stock is, you know, this company is so valuable and it's so worthy to this industry. I can't imagine that it goes below 100 and, you know, the thing goes to zero because, you know, it becomes a bubble burster. Right. And maybe it's one of the frauds that's involved and maybe they get caught up in something like that and they're just left holding the bag. You know, the one thing I learned is I did the whole confused brains for a bull market trade. Right. I left my seat at Goldman Sachs and I left the Cadillac dealer because I was investing in these tech stocks and they were going to the sky. So I thought that I was really smart and didn't need to work at the Cadillac dealer anymore. And so I went off on my own and got beat up 8 ways through Sunday. You know what I mean? To get that lesson. And so that's why now I realize that what I did wrong was I had this tactical trading skill that I developed in the commodity markets, but I developed dogma in my investment practice a little bit, right? And now my strategy is just to point that AR-15 or that weapon from the commodity markets at the equity markets also, you know, and just you and now at the crypto markets and tactically trade everything and apply the same rules to everything. Bubble, I don't give a shit. I'll be gone before everybody gets rinsed in the bubble. You know what I mean? Like I know how to trade that stuff. And so, for example, on a day when the markets have come off, you know, hard in the last couple of days, I'm selling stock with that. But a lot of it I bought a long time ago. So I'm taking profit and I'm getting myself into a position now where I'm light. I have, you know, volatility on my side. I've got my longs that are still holding in there and I've got dry powder, you know. And so now as the market rotates, I'm going with it. Whereas, you know, in the 90s, I would be sitting there like this through volatile days of trading, doing nothing.
Right.
The absolute end of a trader, freezing cold, right? And so when you see your fortune decreasing, you say, all right, at one point you have this dumb conversation with yourself and you say, I'm going to wait this out, right? I'm going to wait this out. Everything's going to be fine. And the next thing you know, you're cut in half again and then it's over, but you don't know it. You know, so I kind of feel like there's that psychology where when you don't see people's attitude change with a big downdraft, you know, and that's the sort of when you realize that the psychology hasn't changed yet. Like these stocks are going down, but everybody around me is still bullish, you know, and then I think it's always going to be a margin situation. I remember one of the best experiences I had during the dot-com crash literally was, and it was very early in the crash. This was with the NASDAQ about 4,500 above 4K on the way down. I had a friend of mine that was invested and levered like mad into one of the high flyers. And he calls me up and he goes, TG, he goes, you're gonna have to explain this to me. And I'm like, what? He goes, I just got a house call. And I was like, a house call? He's like, yeah. I go, you mean a margin call? He goes, no, not a margin call. They didn't ask me for more money. They sold my stock. And I was like, oh God. I was like, these people at the, you know, I didn't think these people, I said, the risk is so great at the brokers now that you aren't getting a call to put up more money on this position that you're already levered into. Yeah. They're selling it, right? They're selling it. You're out. You took the lumps. Here's a report. You're flat. And when I heard that, I was like, oh, this is going to happen to everybody, you know, and he was a really levered guy. So he got taken out early. So that's the one thing that I was able to do as a service to the company that I had started then with six traders on the desk was saying, this is trouble, right? If there are banks taking guys out of positions without asking for a check first, their risk is too big to manage. And so if their risk is too big to manage, then this is all going to spill into the markets. All I can tell you is that lower prices mean selling, right? Not buying. And so that was, you know, there was a way to get on that train there and kind of get ahead of that. But bear market trading was way too hard for a guy that's been bullish for, you know, 5-6 years in a market. So that didn't work out. And then we went the sales trading route, but I got all those lessons by paying for them.
So are they offering those same type of margin loans on crypto right now?
You know, I haven't dug into that. I don't think it's definitely not the same where in this operation where there were, you know, this was the age, the dawn of the day trading firm.
Yeah, right.
And at that point, there were, you know, thousands of day traders sitting in seats at the same time with leverage on top of everything they had. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, I knew we had $5 million levered 5 times. And I knew that there was a lot more leverage out there than that. Right. And we were trying to delever in the downdraft as we saw guys get carried out. So, you know, that was quite obviously a pinprick in the leverage and then just forced selling.
Mm. Yeah. So what's fascinating is people, you know, they just think the market goes up and down, but they don't realize how many transactions and how much psychology is involved to actually make a stock go up or down, you know, especially over a long period of time. I mean, you were just talking about billions and billions of transactions of even if a stock goes straight up, there's still people losing money because they're buying it and selling it at the wrong times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, providing liquidity the wrong way and stuff like that. Yeah. So yeah, that's entirely possible. You mean there was, you know, we had an age where, you know, the investment banks don't commit any risk anymore. There was an age when the clients were calling to buy, you know, 100,000 shares or 200,000 shares of stock, and these guys would just sell it to them. Right. Yeah. We've got inventory, we're dealers, we're big boys. And then next thing you know, they're getting run over. And so that's kind of a little bit of the genesis of how, you know, the market maker got shrunk down on the desk when, you know, all the Wall Street risk taking got sort of eyeballed. It was like, we can't let those guys quote markets for customers. They don't have any edge. Right. Mm-hmm. And they're all getting the dealers are getting run over. And so that's why all those desks shrunk, the risk taking shrunk. The ability to house overnight risk got crushed with Dodd-Frank, and now everything goes into the electronic wood chipper.
That's some incredible insight, Tony. That's really, really mind blowing stuff there. So, all right, I could talk about this for the next 3 hours, but let me go to the S&P 500 chart that I had up before. This is the last 5 days, and you're going to know this chart way better than I am, but I think this is 26. So that would have been Black Friday, if I'm not mistaken. And it looks like I think the market was down about 905 points, obviously thin volume. I think it gapped down, but then on Monday we have the market up. I'm not sure how much, but it kind of goes up and then ends towards its highs. And then looks like Tuesday it really crashed. And then yesterday I thought was really interesting because we had that huge reversal and that I think it was up about maybe 600 points at one time. And then toward the latter stages of the day, it just fell out of bed and closes down, I think, 460 points. And then I guess today we were up about 600. So just this massive whipsaw volatility. What are your first impressions about the action we've seen over the last few days?
All right. So my postmortem on the last, on this week so far is, you know, absolute opportunism by the government and central bank complex with this Omicron variant popping up, right? That's my view is that they took that, they saw that as a deflationary beast and they ran with it, right? So that's why the media and everything is going crazy about the Omicron virus variant, et cetera. The second portion of it is, it seems like a weak.
You think they're trying to combat inflation with narrative?
Oh yeah, I do. I think that there is something along the lines of this is, you know, this is our deflationary pet, and that if we can get that going, then we can take a lot of pressure because you know the politicians are going to manage the optics, not the outcome. Right. All they know is that they're getting heat for gas prices rallying. They're getting heat for food costs rising, and they need to take care of that dynamic in the markets quick, or at least stop it dead in its tracks. So Biden comes out with the two things. Biden comes out last week with the SPR release, which is, you know, to oil traders, it's a joke in terms of something that you think is going to knock the market lower. It's simply not. I don't even think it's worth going into the inner details of that. Let's go to the next portion of the trade, which is where Powell gets his first Biden nomination and probably, I'm assuming, gets a pretty stiff talking to about the inflation beast that he's had wrong, that's now giving the president a headache because they're asking Jen Psaki in the press conference why prices are so high. So now this whole thing becomes a Joe Biden to Powell, like, do something about it, bro. You got the control of money supply. And so he goes out and probably, you know, makes these comments that sort of politicize inflation. You know, he says that, you know, it's, you know, we're going to end transitories out the window. We're going to have to combat this inflation. And what I call, what to me, what he does, and I call it the very same thing, is he opens the Overton window for traders to jump out of. Right. So he's coming out verbally attacking inflation, jawboning that he is going to raise rates, you know, end QE, not slow down, you know, slow down QE. And look what's happened to the markets. The markets take all of that like he just, you know, waved the magic wand and, you know, oil's $10 lower. Natural gas can't get off the mat. You know, commodities, gold is down under 1800 and it's starting to look a little bit easier for them to fend off the inflation story. So, you know, what happens is you've got a market that's long because there's no alternative except being long the S&P. And we have another sell-off episode from the highs into moving average support. And like you say, you know, you picked up that we saw really steep selling. We saw three steep tick index prints this week, right? And I'll explain what that is. The tick index.
Can you explain the tick index?
The tick index on Bloomberg is basically the measure of all the stocks on the New York Stock Exchange, whether they're trading the bid or the offer. Yeah. If half of them are trading the bid and half of them are trading the offer, it registers a zero, right? If they're all trading the offer, it registers up towards 2000 because it's rallying. If they're all trading the bid, it registers negative 2000 because the market's selling off hard. And I'm just saying 2000 is kind of like the extreme on the upside and downside. It oscillates in between there. So my point being, this week we had three major, major tick extremes, which are bigger than 1500 on the downside, right? This has been the formula for the sell-offs from the bottom of the-
In other words, very broad sell-off.
Yeah, exactly. So what it is, it's an intense sell-off, George, is the way to look at that tick index, right? Some days the market is off three or four, shouldn't say that. Some days the market is off 1%, 1.5% at the end of the day, and it's a very quiet day, right? Other days it's off 1.5% after being down 2.5%. Everybody was selling into the hole. And those are the days that the tick index print registers a really low extreme. So my point is this week we've had minus 1800 on Monday, minus 1700 on Tuesday, minus 1675 today on the lows, right? Today, the stock market started off on the lows and rallied. Oil rallied sharply. So this is the kind of formula. Now, the only reason I count those tick index prints is because in all of the sell-offs, it's been this kind of formula where we have two or three consecutive red days, heavy selling, low tick index extremes, and then we landed a moving average and everybody's saying, oh, this is it. You know, this is where inflation bites the head off of the stock market. And next thing you know, we have a red to green day where stocks start off in the red and there's tons of selling and then they have a big rally. It's kind of like what you saw in crude oil today. At crude oil today on the lows was down 4.75% and ended the day up 2.5%. So on the lows, you saw all those commodity trading advisors stopping out and blowing their brains out. And then the market, next thing you know, it rallies. So that's the mechanism that the market clears out length, right? And so now there's not as many longs in the markets. And when the market rallies, there's not as many sellers. So now what I think that you're going to see at some point, I don't know if it's this week or next week, but I think that you see this whole risk complex stabilize and probably gets back on its feet again, quite honestly. That's my view.
Okay. So, and just for the layman there, basically the stock market starts to stabilize. And then it starts going back up.
Yeah. So what we're going to see, you know, we pull into moving average support and then now we'll see some more distribution where, you know, you have weak hands selling into stronger hands and stronger hands chasing some stocks, things like that. And, you know, next thing you know, there's really nobody else that needs to lighten up their position. due to the Omicron variant, because we're really not locking down America again or something like that, you know? So I'm kind of looking for that kind of a bat signal where we get this thing that we're in the clear, because it's either now or later, George, right? Yeah. We're either going to have a reopening rotation now, or we're going to have to do it after we do whatever Omicron exercise we're going to have, but there's still going to be a reopening inflation push, you know, out of this, both economically and I think kind of sentimentally for the markets. So that, you know, I'm not looking at this dip as anything other than what we've seen in the past.
Especially if it's narrative driven. I mean, you know, it's one thing if the variant, let's say, is really kind of pushing aside the efficacy of the medicine, we'll say. So then people realize that maybe the vaxxed are now just as unvaxxed as everyone else. But then there's another component there, like you were saying, which I'd never even thought of, that the government really wants this inflation narrative to go away and go away quickly. And, you know, to the point where Biden's trying to get all the oil reserves out, like that'll do anything. And then, so this, they're using this as an opportunity to bring down the stock market, to bring down gas prices, oil prices, and hopefully bring down prices throughout the rest of the economy. So this narrative can shift to something else to where Biden doesn't look as bad.
100%, 100%. You know, they'll get it out of the headlines. And, you know, this is, you know, I finally got to interview, I followed your footsteps, George, and got to interview Doomberg for my interview series on Real Vision today. And it was great.
Oh, great.
Yeah, I loved your interview with him. It was one of the best things I watched all year, and because I love him so much and we're friends, and I was like, all right, now I need at you so I can ask you my questions, you know? And it was a good different spin on the conversation you had. But why did I bring him up again?
I know he's big in commodities, and we were talking about the narrative that it's either, in my mind, it's either this variant is going to show that the vaxxed might be unvaxxed, in which case now we go back to March of 2020, where this is kind of a right hook from Tyson that's no one was really expecting, and then you could see significant downside. But what you're saying is you don't really see it that way, because maybe the appetite for these more draconian measures, at least in the United States, there's no appetite for that whatsoever. And
that's right.
But maybe more so, the Biden administration is taking a ton of heat. And it shows it in his approval rating for this inflation. And that's one thing that people, you know, they can see whatever they are hear in the media, but when they see their grocery bill go up by 20% or gas prices at $5 a gallon or their rent increase by 20% per annum, that's when they start to get pissed. That's when it becomes real, quote unquote. And so the Biden administration is trying to go to the media and say, hey, guys, let's overplay this new variant thing to bring the stock market back down, to bring oil prices back down, and therefore to bring down the rate of inflation. So my constituents aren't as pissed off at me, for lack of a better phrase, and to get them to vote for me in the future.
That feels like what it's like, you know. It's managing the whole thing. You know, they'd rather the stock market stay up, but they know that they need commodities to go down. And so they're willing to accept all that now. I think that, you know, we're going to have the market is going to give diminishing return attention to the new variants as we go. Right. Doomberg went up. That was what I brought him up for in his in our conversation this morning. He mentioned, you know, after 9/11 terror attacks, you know, that rattled the markets. And then every bomb that went off after that had less and less effect on the tape until you hear the bomb headline and you look at the S&P and it doesn't tick anywhere.
Right.
And it's like, yeah, there goes another one. Right. So now what are we going to do? We did, you know, alpha, beta, delta variant, delta, lambda variant. We skipped over G, we're in Omicron. And now the market is like, you got one more shot at this. Literally one more shot at the market buying this variant. I think it's this one, quite honestly.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capital's Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for. Tony, do you think that could, your hypothesis for the United States could be what we're seeing play out in Europe? Or, you know, maybe that's not their entire motivation, but and what I'm talking about specifically is like Austria. You know, they're going into full lockdown mode. They said initially it was for the unvaxxed, but then they said, well, no, it's just for everybody. Do you think that they're seeing inflation get too hot there as well and saying, well, I mean, a good way to combat this would be to just lock everyone in a cage, and we've got a great excuse because the case count has spiked. Do you think there's anything to that?
I do. I think that they're facing a really dire potential energy crisis this winter.
You know, there you go. From, I forgot about that too. That's another great point.
You spoke about it with Doomberg. You guys went over it like a glove, right? I mean, what we've got now is we've got Europe, you know, because of their ESG push, you know, they're letting out supply. And so they're down to 70% or so of their normal natural gas reserves. They're depending on Vladimir Putin now to set the price of gasoline, the price of natural gas through the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. But they're making the active decision, the political decision, to hold that up for various different reasons, right? So at that point, it's like, look, that's, you know, that's not a technical holdback there. You know, Putin is gonna send gas through the pipeline if you guys open the thing up, and it seems like they're dragging their feet on the regulation for that. So I can't, you know, there could be something to that without a doubt, that this is the way they'll say, yeah, you know, how we'll do is we'll shut the economy off. That's how we'll get rid of the inflation. And, you know, you worry about the you know, nefarious angle that it could be, but you try not to chalk up to, you know, bad intentions what might be explained by stupidity. And that, if you look at the leaders calling the shots on both sides of the pond on energy policy, I mean, they're both directly and observably imperiling their nation, without a doubt, by assigning pricing opportunity to a potential foe, right? So Vladimir Putin now gets to set the price of natural gas in Europe. I don't think that's a great idea for them. And now, you know, Saudi Arabia and OPEC are going to be setting the price of crude for, you know, WTI crude oil. And the thought process going on at JP Morgan right now, and it's a very interesting oil call, is that they don't, Saudis no longer have the reserves to really wag the oil price like they used to. You know, they used to have an extra 4 or 5 million barrels a day of reserves. JP Morgan estimates that that's going to be down to 2 million barrels a day of production in reserves, coming out in reserves. And so that kind of limits their ability. And JP Morgan's call is, as a result of that, we're going to see oil north of 100, because once this gets going, Saudi Arabia is not going to have the same amount of length to pile into the market. So we might have, you know, they're not going to have another output cut. Excuse me. I don't think they're going to allow any output hike, certainly, after they've seen that, you know, lockdowns are potential. There's a variant going around. You know, that's what Prince Abdulaziz said right after Biden asked OPEC to start pumping more oil and say that the high gas price was because those producers weren't pumping. Abdulaziz, even before the Omicron variant went around, said, hey, man, you know, this COVID's still going around the world. We're at lockdown risk. I can't put more oil into the markets, right? Mm-hmm. Like he knew something, if you want to get spooky about it, because next week the Omicron variant came out and oil went down $10, you know? So, yeah. You know, you try not to get too tinfoil hatty here, but if you want to connect some dots, they're all right out there to connect.
Yeah, that's some incredible insight, Tony. I'm going to have to think that through. I think that might call for a whiteboard video next week. I'm sitting here looking at Josh. That's a good one. That is really connecting some potential dots. I always say, you know, these are thought experiments. I try not to make predictions. I mean, I'm not a pro like you, so I don't make predictions. I just try to think about the world around us and try to explain it better and then explain possibilities. And then always say there's no certainties. It's just the probabilities. And you guys have to figure this stuff out on your own. But I want to explain it to you and bring it to your attention, because the probability of that being true is far greater than zero.
Oh, yeah. Oh, 100%. All of it. I mean, the probability of this energy crisis morphing across the pond is greater than zero, by the way.
Yeah.
Right. If we, you know, we're just at the beginning, you know, where this administration is 1 year into turning fossil fuels off. They've got three more, you know, so in as much as you continue to see them do the same thing, I'm of the mindset that to make a statement, they might, because we're weakening the military and we're clearly weakening ourselves in the big global picture. My guess, Biden might drain the SPR.
And that's our reserves,
our strategic petroleum reserve. We've got about 600. The U.S. has about 650 million barrels in our strategic petroleum reserve, of which we said we're about to sell 50. Okay, so we're going to be now under 600 million barrels.
And even selling that 50, to your earlier point, it's pissing in the wind. It's not going to do anything. It's
just to go into that. Pure theatrics to go into how that works. It's going to be 32 million barrels on a swap, which means they're going to go into an agreement with somebody and say, we'll sell it to you now and buy it back later. So it's going to go right back into the SPR at a later date, and 18 million barrels being sold outright. Ready for this one? The 18 million barrels sold outright are sour crude, right? Not light sweet crude that's deliverable to Cushing, Oklahoma.
Right.
Sour crude oil. So who are the big consumers?
So you can't use for gas, bottom line.
Well, you can, but to break it up, you're going to cause a lot more CO2 to go into the atmosphere. So the buyers of this sour crude, which is a higher sulfur content, China and India, they've been the two biggest global consumers of oil anyway, and we're selling them the oil that they're happy to burn because they're not shooting themselves in the foot with this carbon emissions policy. So we're essentially saying, yeah, we have this oil that you guys burn. We're going to sell it out of our reserve to you. It's not going to have any effect on the price of gasoline. It's a day's worth of oil burning, right? I mean, if we burn 10 million barrels a day and they're going to sell 18 million barrels, who cares? You know, so it's, you know, that part, the volume part is pissing in the wind. But the fact that they're selling, you know, the product that India and China have been consuming for the last 5 years, incrementally more every year. You know, China's oil consumption has gone up 10% a year for the last decade. They inhale sour crude. We're handing them sour crude through the SPR at a discount.
Yeah. If you want to take it to an extreme there, we're negatively impacting the environment from an administration that says that that's our biggest risk moving forward.
Yeah.
I think it's the epitome of just hypocrisy, really.
It's insanity. You know, the biggest one was, you know, canceling the pipelines, Canada, you know, that now we're going to be transporting that oil. We're going to be importing that oil on trucks and trains driven by gasoline and coal rather than sending them down in a pipeline. So I don't think you can get, I think that's why they did that first. I think they just blew your mind open and said, yeah, no, we're the pipeline, the aerodynamic thing for transporting oil, not doing it. I think that's why they did it first, because then everything after that is like, it's not as dumb as closing the pipeline.
Yeah. And there's people in the United States that are actually trusting these politicians and central planners, trusting their health advice for their injecting a foreign substance into the bloodstream of their five-year-old. Those are the same people that you're trusting. I mean, it's just... Man.
Yeah, making bad decisions in a very complex energy platform. You know what I mean? Like creating base power load for, you know, for utilities. That's a big job. That's a very serious job. And, you know, we're making
it
much
more no principles. They say one thing and they say that they're for X, Y, and Z. And then behind the scenes, they do the opposite of that. I mean, it's so blatantly a parent. It frustrates me because people take them at their word when it's just so obvious they're lying to us. They constantly, every single thing they do is just for theatrics. It's just for narrative. It's just for propaganda. Mm-hmm. There's no principles behind it. If you think Biden or anyone in the administration, or I would say the World Economic Forum or the IMF, cares about the environment or carbon emissions, you're just lying to yourself more than they're lying to you in the first place.
I agree. We've got Larry Fink out there selling ESG funds, George.
Oh, yeah.
He's commanding a lot of narrative, you know, through this whole thing. And, it's a double shot in the foot from the SPR sale to the canceling the pipeline. And so, you know, we have to be really careful about this heading into winter, heading into the next 3 years, et cetera, et cetera. But you reason, you know, my biggest thing is the reason that you say, like, this is madness, this is patent insanity. And the reason that we can't make the connection and why you and I are so angry is because the media doesn't know how to hold them to task on this.
Or that
you and I, or they're unwilling to, or they're instructed not to, or they're paid not to, whatever it is. But you and I know how to say, Joe, cancel the pipeline. You're going to put it on a train or a truck. It's going to get down here some other way. And then we're burning fossil fuels. What are we talking about? You know what I mean? That might shake somebody up that was watching that. But if nobody says that, it's like, oh, bravo, closing a pipe. Wow, how freaking righteous. Yeah. Fucking A, close them all. You know, close them all. Right. Sounds great. Right. Gas is $12 a gallon. I can't get gas. What is that? That's crazy. You know, so we're going to have to surf this out for a little while longer, my man.
All right, Tony. I know I've kept you a long time. We got 672 people on the live stream right now. Do you have time for a couple calls?
It's absolutely, man. I'm here for you. Thank you so much, George. So anything I can do to help?
Okay, so Mr. Market Mania. Oh, nice. I can't. Hold on, before we go for Mr. Market Mania, I know you're on hold, but I can't take you this time because we got several people in queue, and I want to give some other people some opportunities. So maybe let's try in tomorrow or the next day, something like that. But sir, what is your name?
James.
James. Okay, great, James. You have a question for the Mr. Tony Greer?
Absolutely. So there's kind of a ceiling on the VIX at about 28.5. It's more of a resistance level. The expected move to the SPX for the week was 150 something points. So that's down to 4,440 on the SPY. We've seen a 75% move in the VIX over the last week. And we've only had a 3.5% correction. Do you think this looks like a Volmageddon scenario where we only get a 7, 8, 10% correction, but the VIX jumps to, you know, 40, 50, 60?
No, I think the exact opposite, actually, James. I try to keep myself from selling stocks unless they're within my framework when the VIX is at 28, 27, 28. I generally am trying to be a buyer of stocks, right? In that time period when the VIX is that elevated. I don't think, you know, you have to look at this, compare it to the Volmageddon, you know, lockdown VIX spike, right? Pretty much every VIX spike has been incrementally lower from there, right? Like, you know, we had that one high into the 50s or you know, what do we go as high as? Let me just put it in front of me for 1 second. But sure. It's kind of like since the lockdown spike in the VIX from March of 2020 up to 80, you know, you can kind of draw that descending line down, you know, where the highs were in June, the high in the VIX was, you know, around four in the mid 40s. Then in September of 2020, it was, the high was around 40. And then you get into this year and you see all of the dips in the S&P came with lower highs in the VIX, right? So my point is, if you look at it, it makes sense. If you look at, and I charted this for my clients, if you look at the last five VIX breaks up into the 30s or so and pair those up with the S&P dip, right? You start looking at it and saying, okay, you know, the last one, the VIX got up into the 30s, the S&P was at 4450. And then the last time you look and see the VIX got up to the 30s, the S&P was at 3,800 or 4,000. And then the last time it got up there was at 3,800. So my point is, I have to get in the habit as a trader of buying stocks when the VIX is elevated, because when I look back on the track record of the VIX, every time it spikes up here, I look at the S&P and said, I better have been buying stocks there because you don't get another chance.
Right.
You know what I mean? So I'm looking at this very much as when the VIX elevates like this, I'm looking to be a buyer of stocks. And a lot of times in my personal view matrix, I'm selling stock, but that's because I bought a stock at 10, it ran to 18, and my trailing stop went right up with it to 17. So that when I sell, I'm making a profit. I'm locking in profit when I sell. A lot of people are waiting until they're losing money to make a sale, right? So if you stick to your tactical trading, you're actually making sales and being prepared to buy the market when it's down here and when the VIX is this elevated. So that's kind of how I'm looking at this, James, without going and leaving you open if you want to ask a follow-up question. But I'm looking to be a buyer of stocks when the VIX is elevated like this.
Okay.
Follow-up. XME.
Yeah.
Have you gotten back into it? You said you took on a position a couple months ago. I was wondering if you bought back in more. And I want your top two oil stocks.
Yeah, you got it. All right. So, yep, XME, I'm out of. I got taken out of yesterday for a scratch. Right. So that is, you know, that's another case in point of a stock of a sector that I got back into for the third time 3 weeks ago. And it ticked up my way. And so I kind of I slide my sliding stop up with it and I get out if it takes me out. So when I slid my stop up to break even for the XME, that's a popular strategy for me. Whenever I get the chance to move my trading stop up to break even on a trade, I do it. I do it religiously because you know what that does? It stops you from losing money. So my point, no, I'm serious. Yeah, my point is I've put stocks on, I put positions on and I've been in the money, and then I've let them go back to where I bought them and then let them go against me. And now I'm out of the money and I sell them because now I'm furious because that is a miserable P&L swing.
Absolutely.
Right? So I learned, don't do that anymore. Right. If it gets back to your price that you bought it, just sell it right on a stop. And so now what happened? No blood. I had the upside exposure. I had the chance to be in it. Didn't really go anywhere. I had to sell it. Okay, I'm out. I have less risk now. It leaves me available to watch the market with open eyes, right? So I'm out of XME right now because it just looks too dangerous. The other reason I'm out of XME is because I'm still holding Freeport, right? So I feel like I have too much risk right now that if copper does blow, I don't want to get caught long XME and Freeport. So this is part of my strategy of being nimble, if you will. And you know, like, if I'm an equity bull and when the market goes down big, I sell stock. You know what I mean? Like I participate. I go with the flow, man. I'm a trader. I see bad news on the tape. Everybody's selling. I make a fucking sale. You know what I mean? Because if you sit there and wear everything that you've got on through a high volatility event, you get pinned. So my two favorite oil stocks. I'm not a stock picker. I've never been good at picking stocks. I only pick stocks when they pick me. For example, like I fall in love with a company like Yeti and the thing goes public and I'm like, yeah, that's a stock that picked me. I didn't pick Yeti. So in the energy sector, I look at, I'm still kind of keeping it simple with Exxon because I like their pivot into carbon capture. And I think that if, you know, anything is going to survive, I think that, you know, the Exxon, Chevron, you know, the big ones are going to add another vertical to survive this ESG push by measuring carbon capture. So they're fully equipped to do that. And I think you got to go with the bigger, you know, I think this is what I think. I think you have to go with a little bit. I would go with a big cap and a small cap, quite honestly, because I think that you go with a big cap stock. This is just my preference.
Something like that.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, so the big cap one is going to give you the exposure to the carbon capture business because they're going to have huge CapEx and they're going to say, all right, we'll pivot some CapEx into, you know, carbon capture and storage. And now we've got this vertical that we can work on alongside with whatever limited drilling that we can do and E&P. And then if you pick a smaller mid-cap stock, a really specialized shale play or something like that, like Range Resources or something like that, which I'm a fan of, have some natural gas exposure and some more oil exposure. If you pick a smaller cap stock that's not likely to pivot into carbon capture business, then you have a much purer play on the fossil fuel recovery if you're kind of, I'm always looking for what I call ESG fade trades, because eventually ESG is going to fall on its face, because we're not going to, you know, we're not going to be on wind and solar everything at any point.
I mean, there's no way to recycle the solar panel. It's just toxic waste dump.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think we're putting a plane up in the air with, you know, 2,500 tons of you know, cargo on electricity anytime soon, but I could be wrong.
You put a windmill on a plane. That'd probably work well, because it's like going fast. That's gonna
might work. It might be a self-propelling wind-powered plane. That'd be pretty cool, right?
Yeah, put five alternators on a Tesla, call it a day.
I like it. I hope that was helpful, my man.
Yeah, that was awesome. Thank you, guys. Oh, yeah, by the way, cool. I don't know if you can see that.
$1. Oh, Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe. Ah, nice. There's a good artifact. NFT that thing.
Yeah.
Maybe I will.
Yeah. All right. Let's do one more call. Josh, who do we got? All right. Caller, what is your name?
Ryan.
Hi, Ryan. You're on with Tony Greer.
Hey, guys. So I wanted to ask further some more stuff about, like, so we're talking about lockdowns and stuff, and Europe's going pretty hard into that. And I do think that in America, especially, we're kind of fighting that attitude more. But the idea that the central banks and the governments want to force deflation, like, on the world, basically, that's just going to force the policy error from the Fed or central banks even quicker, because they're kicking that inflation can just back another winter. So then instead of it being bad this year, they're just going to double that next year. And people, normal people or average people like me, you know, they don't always get that that's what happens or that's what's going to happen. So, like, I've been trying to explain that to people and whatnot, because once you kind of explain that, to your point about how all the ESG stuff, they then get that, oh yeah, that pipeline being closed, well, that kind of put us in the situation right now. But they don't get that initially, because, like you guys always say, they take politicians, everyone at their word, or it sounds great, so it must be great, even though under the surface that's not really.
They confuse intentions with results.
Yeah. Well put. Well, can I, what question can I answer for you, Ryan? I think I missed a question in there, and I apologize.
Oh, like, so with them forcing the deflation, do you think they're actually going to be able to do that, or how long are they going to be able to do that before the policy error happens?
Yeah, I think, well, maybe if I can articulate that in a different way, maybe can they have a soft landing? Because if they create this deflation, then they're going to have to print more money, which is going to exacerbate the problem later on down the road.
That's what it feels like to me. That's what it feels like. They're going to, you know, like we said, you know, if we have another, you know, the country is trying to get to full capacity in, you know, across a number of spheres, you know, from airline travel to, you know, TSA checkpoints and rail travel and road travel. So we're trying to get back to a certain level of economic opening. And now they're pushing the deflation lockdown narrative. But just like you said, what this usually leads to is, imagine this. So imagine, let's just say, there's a global lockdown for 3 months. Central bank is going to come out and say, okay, we're going to have to add another $2 trillion of securities that you guys are selling to our balance sheet to stem the slide of the markets, which is going to have to happen because we're locking down the economy. So what's that going to require? More monetization. I mean, then you're really setting up for a later date inflation, right? Because by then, maybe the Fed balance sheet is north of 10. I mean, imagine going into a lockdown, the Fed's balance sheet went from 4 to 7 trillion during the lockdown, and now we're pushing 9 trillion.
Yeah.
Imagine going into a lockdown with a $10 trillion balance sheet. What might they have to do to it? Right. They might have to expand it and buy all of the securities that people are selling for the second time around. So it's like, to me, that's more inflationary, right? That's more stimulus is coming. Here's another lockdown bill. Right. Here's another lockdown stimulus. Here's another lockdown everything. And so that's more inflation down the road. You know, so it's kind of like, you know, like we say, they manage the optics and not the outcomes, is they do everything they can to get the heat off them so that the people in the press conferences will stop asking those pesky questions. You know, and so I think, you know, it's going to be a treacherous thing to manage. But yeah, it feels very much we're in a kick the can situation trying to get the inflation beast to come out later. And that's really scary when we're, you know, in it with this guy for 3 years. How much inflation can he create, and how much farther down the road can he kick the can? So that's kind of one of the things that I lose sleep at night over.
All right.
Yeah,
great.
I understand that.
Yeah, great question. So, Tony, I know for the sake of time, we'll kind of end it there. That was just an incredible, incredible conversation. I learned a lot right there, and you've got my wheels really, really turning. Nice. For
awesome,
sure.
Man.
I'm going to have to think about this one a lot over the weekend. So one last time for my viewers who want to find out more about what you do, where can they go? I mean, I cannot recommend your retail. You say you do it 4 times a week. I can't recommend that enough.
Thank you very much, George. The note is called The Morning Navigator. You can find it at tgmacro.com. You can email me at tony@tgmacro.com. I'm happy to accept, throw you some samples or something like that. But George, I just want to say, thank you for having me. When I'm going over a really busy, volatile market and you pop up in my DM and ask you to talk about markets, I jump out of my seat for that opportunity, just so you know. Honestly, so anytime you ask, as long as I'm available, you got me.
Yeah, cool. I'll try to give you a little bit more of a heads up next time, but let's try to do it like once a month or so.
More than 10 minutes would be good, George. I do have a schedule,
Yeah, but fine. Next time you got to wear the Rebel Capitalist shirt and the Fed hat. For those of you watching, I just FedExed one to Tony. So he's got that right there in his house.
I do. It went directly through the wash, but I already told Gene I might wear that whole ensemble to a concert one night. I love it. The Rebel Capitalist Pro and the Fed. It makes such a bold statement across the board. I love it.
You got to take a selfie and post it on Twitter if you do.
I'm going to. I got it when I got it out of the box and my son grabbed it and put it on. And so I'm like, where the hell is my Rebel Capitalist shirt? And I see him in it and I'm like, okay, now it goes in the laundry. Just what it's like around here with a teenager,
That's great. Well, Tony, I'll let you go. Thanks again. Can't wait to do it again.
Yeah, me neither, man. Thanks.